Gaming on the Frontier. This is Bruce.
This is Trav.
And this is Jonathan.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of buying everything and finding out that now nobody has anything anymore.
You bought all the things.
So this is an Econ 101 podcast? What?
Yes, indeed. Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. This week we are talking about what do you have to pay for and why? Because that's a big question in a lot of campaigns. We're going to be talking about what kind of monetary systems work and don't work in campaigns, especially based on genre, and what are some of the alternatives, and how does the genre affect that sort of thing. Let's take that information, okay, and then start thinking about, how does that work with a particular kind of game, okay? So, for example, is that if the game you're playing is heroic, where you're primarily focused on doing great and noteworthy deeds, okay? You're probably not going to want to deal with the with tracking things like wealth and influence, unless that directly affects your ability to achieve the goals of the campaign that you're doing. So, because when you think about, again, the people out, in movies where they're all, riding around with knights or, they did a little bit of it, in Star Wars, but pretty much, it was like we did a quick deal, of selling a land speeder and we've got all the cash we need in order to buy ourselves the fastest piece, hunk of junk, in Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
And from that point on, they never talk about money at all in the entire Star Wars series. Nobody ever talks about money.
Yeah, really?
Han owed Jabba money and then he got captured because, it's like, I'll pay you triple, Jabba. You're losing out on a bargain. There's Jabba watching them getting walked away to the sail barge. Yeah.
It was always just kind of supporting details. It was never a plot point.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, everyone always, no one seemed to go without food. No one was starving. It was all about, doing, the ship that they needed was always seemed to be there or something they could use, and it was just a matter, a lot of times it came down to finding the right person to help them, at which point that person would throw their resources at them and they would continue the story.
Yeah.
So I'm saying heroic games are like that, where we don't worry about the things that everybody else worries about, like making mortgage payments and, Hans has a lot of trouble with the Millennium Falcon breaking down, okay, but he doesn't talk about the fact that he doesn't have any money to fix it.
Yeah.
It's just the parts aren't there.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
They did do a lot of that, by the way, with the Mandalorian. He spends a lot of time talking about money.
Yeah, with and he's got his the lady Peli, the one who dated a Jawa. Yeah, her. That's kind of his go-to mechanic for. Okay, I'm on Tatooine, and I know to go to Peli, she'll hook me up, even though those damn droids are there, and I hate droids. Yeah. Yeah, it
and all those and the critters
yeah.
that also work on stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just saying is the Mandalorian is considerably more gritty.
Yeah.
You know, and they care about things like how many credits and stuff like that in that show because it's not very heroic. You know, it's though they do a number of really heroic things. But, you know, whenever we get into the area where it's heroic, then suddenly he's, you know, pulling out a plate of Beskar and somebody who apparently does it because they love doing it, fires up the forge and turns it into whatever he needs.
Or he can call on favors, you know, like, oh, he needed, or what was that at the end of the Book of Boba Fett, where he's there with Pelly and Fennec Shand is there and she tosses Mando the bag of money and he tosses it back. This is on the house because it's Boba Fett, technically a fellow Mandalorian, albeit a clone, but still, you know, that's the whole Jango Fett thing. But still, it was, he did it out of respect and we're going right back into the heroic. We are doing it because we are Mandalorians. We fight together, we die together. This is the way, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's not about the money.
Yeah, right.
Right. So... And like I say, he you know doesn't seem to ever say, gee, you know, I'd fly, except I only got like a quarter of a tank left.
Yeah,
that stuff doesn't happen. Okay, so
well, no, they even did that in Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one where they landed at nowhere, and you know, Star-Lord and Gamora are there talking. It was before they were dancing to the Elvis music, or Sam Cooke, I think. Yeah, God. They're murdering us here on the fuel rates. We might have to do this, you know, do this job just to get out of here. You know, yeah. They'll bring it up as a light detail, even though they're heroic. Just you know, inane chatter kind of thing.
But you know, Iron Man never talks about the development cost for his armor. I mean, you know that he's walking every new version is a billion-dollar suit, right?
Oh, no. What's the thing? Yeah, take away the suit. What are you? Genius. What is it? Genius, playboy, billionaire, philanthropist. And even Black Widow just went. He's kind of right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Oh.
So I'm just saying he can do that. Okay. But, and, you know, which is why he has all those wonderful toys, same as Batman. Okay. So, all right. So if your game is heroic, then you're probably not going to want to deal with this sort of thing at all, you know, because it takes your eye off of the real goal of the campaign, which is to do great mythic type things. If you're going to have wealth in the game, you're going to need to think about what kind of wealth that you want to do of the five we listed. Probably not the one where you add up all your coins. Okay. The second version is gritty. Which is where your cyberpunk is. This is where, your D&D is, and a lot of other games where you know there are shortages are normal, and you have to keep your resources you know in good order, or you're gonna find yourself without what you need when you need it. In a futuristic setting, you have to pay for the air you breathe, or you get thrown out an airlock because you know we can't have any deadbeats. You know, it's so bad in Cyberpunk that in Cyberpunk Edge Runners, the guy watches his mom basically die because she lost her corporate job and her health insurance wasn't available, so the ambulances wouldn't show up because they weren't going to get paid. So she literally died. You know, she died. I think she didn't quite die in the car. Someone finally took her to a hospital, but it was pointless at that point.
I think if I remember correctly, because it has been a while since I've seen it, I think it was she had insurance, but it wasn't like top tier platinum. So the med tech prioritized the higher rated people first. Even though they were probably most obviously dead, but they had the higher insurance rating, so they got looked at first, even though she was obviously a... It's been a while since...
They weren't doing triage of the kind that you expect.
No, yeah, their triage is based off of funding as opposed to, you know, actual need.
Right. And, you know, and there's lots and lots of... You know, this happens a lot more in stories than in role-playing games, okay? You know, but it does happen. where, you know, and sometimes it's actually a good thing. It's, you know, where basically you're in a situation, the bad guys show up, and they get a call and it says, oh, yes, you know, so-and-so's payment bounced. And they look around and say, we're out of here. And you're like, you're not going to kill us? No, we're not getting paid, so we're not going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not going to do this job for free.
You live for now.
Go die on your own nickel. So, yeah. So gritty can be like that. You know, you might have, you have to make the cars that you drive, you know, you might have to steal that limousine because you can't afford it.
It's a point where money or resources are a plot point now.
Right.
Maybe not all the time, but enough that you have to start worrying about it.
Right. You know, there's a lot of anime out there where so-and-so has a mom in the hospital and she's like a long-term patient. And they basically say, you have to keep paying us X amount of dollars per month or we're going to put her out. And so that drives the protagonist to either engage in crime or have to go and do risky things or, you know, take, you know, basically, as you say, it's a plot point. It makes them, forces them to take certain jobs rather than just, you know, living an easy life or just, I just want to run this noodle shop here. Well, that's not going to keep your mom, with her chemo treatments. Okay, well, then I guess I'm going to have to go and go work for Mr. Big because he'll pay those bills. And or the government comes in and says, you used to be so-and-so. And he says, yeah, but I'm retired. He says, well, you know, we'll pay for your daughter's heart transplant if you go and do this job.
And that's where he embraces his inner Morty with the finger gun. You SOB, I'm in. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So I'm just saying, is it gritty? You know, as you said, these items having to do with wealth and supplies, they become plot points. It's not like, you know, you don't just expect them to be there now. If you need them to be there, then it may drive the actions that you take. That's why you have to say to yourself, what kind of game am I playing? You know, and because based upon that, you may say things like, well, you know, I might want to, you know, I'm playing a gritty game, but I'd like to be somebody who has, you know, a title or something like that, because it gives me a little oomph where everybody else doesn't have it. You know, because every time I played D20 Modern, I was always trying to raise my wealth rating in those games because I knew that with that, a lot of these gritty type situations we could just go away because I was above that now and the other people had to deal with it, but I didn't. I could just waltz in, you know, lay down a 50 and buy the best, or I should say a 50 credit, because see, the nice thing about credits is it's not linked to any monetary source, and you can, you know, you don't have to worry about it as time goes on. Let's say a $500 credit bill, you know, chip, and get the best whiskey in the house, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of why I've adopted the influence point system from Second World Sourcebook, because 99% of the time in my OGL campaigns that I'm running, my characters, it is one of the things. Money is no longer an issue. And so I'll tell them, knock your wealth down. I'll tell you how low you can knock your wealth down and how much IP you get. And a lot of them now have the Second World Source, so they can look it up themselves. And I'm just like, yeah, you may have a wealth of, you know, 13, which is like $1,200 or 1,200 gold pieces worth of something. So $12,000. So you may not have a lot of liquid assets, but you have, you know, again, what Doctor Who called mojo, you know, where, yeah, you're throwing around influence and you get things just because somebody hooks you up. And it's sort of the thing of, somebody who is poor and wins the lotto. There's a French term. Nouveau riche. Yeah. Where where you get these people that are, well, relatively rural, and it's, you know, the person you grit your teeth at because this person lives in a trailer park, just won a $40 million lottery. Yeah, they got 40, well, okay, with taxes, $25 million. They're still new rich. They don't have the connections that they would have with other established rich people going, well, you know, we could, you know, invite you to the party this weekend up in the Hamptons. You know, they don't have that. They're just like, I'm going to buy me all of these TVs. I want 20. They think small, even though they got the money. So they would have
they the high wealth score. They think small on a larger scale.
Right. Yeah. No. What? No, Jonathan, what's the term? How will you know that I'm rich? Because the mistakes and poor life, the life choices I make will be glorious. Yeah.
I'm filled with glorious purpose.
And I'm raising my hand at that because I would. Oh, no. Oh, I would. Oh, no.
I'm just reminded of the story.
I heard of one lotto winner.
And I think it was in the UK who, after they won the lotto and it was a huge jackpot, they basically just built a racetrack in their. They bought a huge house because, of course, that's what you do. And they put a racetrack in the backyard and wrecked cars on it constantly until they were broke, like, within 3 years.
So they demolition derbied their way to poverty, huh?
Yeah.
That and the drug parties.
That'll do it.
Oh, gee. Well, yeah. I think. But, no, the ones that get me, and we've had them up here in Michigan. Hi, I just won $3 million in the lotto. I'm here in Michigan. I'm moving to Florida, where I won another $4 million on another lotto. I'm like, USOB, just stay in that state. Don't come back. Yeah, just, you know, those are the people that I just really am like, you know. But yeah, nouveau riche, and that's how it's reflected in the wealth rating influence point system that I use. You can have a 40 wealth, but if you have no IP, that means you're nouveau riche. And that's how I explain to my players. Now, if you knock down your wealth a little, where you have... Once more with feeling, we can edit that part out. Where you knock your wealth rating down a little, it means that you have less liquid assets.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
Okay, like, we're just going to move this glass over here. Yeah.
You're converting that liquid assets into like investments that give you influence.
Or you're literally giving it away and getting, you know, positive viewpoint from other people, you know?
Yeah. The IP, yeah. A lot of times they have influence points as, well, it's in the second world setting. Oh, you'll get this award or a medal or a pin you can wear. And it's considered a 2IP award, which means you can use that 2IP. I mean, it's a one shot. You still have the award, but just once you spend the 2IP, yeah, you kind of shot your load, but you managed to get in at a good party, or you managed to talk to the mayor of the city, or you managed to, you know, get a big favor done that furthers the campaign. So yeah, influence points usually are you're trading gold pieces. 1,000 gold pieces is worth 1 IP. You're trading it for help later on in some form.
Yeah, either
material or personnel.
Right. They did a good thing like this on Dharma and Greg, where they had their first child, and the mother says, "Well, we need to go and have him seen by." So-and-so, the top pediatrician in the city, you know. And so she picks up the phone and she calls them up and says, yes, this is so-and-so. And I'd like to bring my grandson in for Dr. X to examine. And she says, yes, I know he doesn't take new patients. Okay. Could you walk over to the window and look at the side of the building you're in? Uh-huh. What's the name on that building? She says, oh, so-and-so. Yes. I am that so-and-so. Yes.
Hi.
And the doctor's available. Oh, how wonderful.
And your appointment will be, ma'am, at, yeah.
Yes. And we will be there then. Thank you very much. And just hangs up. I mean, You know, they built that building, you know, a decade ago. Could have even been done by the parent of the person who's doing the speaking. Okay, you know, I mean, this could be a very old building, but the point was is that, you know, when you say, "Hi, I'm so and so Westinghouse," you know, then people go, "Oh, well, let's see if we can help you."
Or, you know, Ford or Firestone or yeah. Oh no! It just with that it's yeah. Then it's like, and then if they really get it's like yeah, I'm the daughter of that person, and yeah, I can call my father, or you know, it could be just that, or they could be, you can help me now, or I can call my father, the person who you know the building has that name, and then they're like, oh, and the appointment is here at 10 o'clock for Monday. We'll see you then. Yeah, and that's when you're having to kind of strong arm it a little to drive the point home, but yeah, the result is still the same. Just
and sometimes it can make all it literally can make the difference between living a life and not living a life. Because if you watch the movie As Good as It Gets, here you have a woman whose child has chronic lung issues, and she's a waitress, you know, and she doesn't make much money. So she's constantly having to bring her son into the emergency room to be basically looked at by these baby docs that are basically just, you know, residents, you know, from medical school. They're real doctors, but
yeah,
they're still not fully, you know, fully dried off yet. So, and they just can't seem to help him. And, you know, and of course they, all the money that's, you know, she can't pay the bills. They always end up basically just having to walk away from their bills because of that. And, finally, she has this interaction with this very famous, writer, and who, when she has to take her son into, He's a little odd, you know. He's neurodivergent, and when she has to take her son into the hospital, she doesn't show up for her shift to serve him his breakfast at the restaurant he likes to go to. He gets somebody else who doesn't know how to do it properly, so he finds this out, picks up the phone, he gets, you know, it's not the best one in the city, but he gets a very capable pediatric allergist, something like that, you know, who basically goes over, checks out her son, and says, "Yeah, he's on all the wrong medications. I know exact. You know, he needs a couple of tests, but I'm sure we'll figure out a way to get him moving along and improving and stuff like that." And she says, "Well, I can't afford that." He says, "It's already taken care of." He says, I'm already paid. I'm here at your disposal, you know." And then she looks over.
Oh God! Wait a minute. Okay, movie's name again?
Movie is As Good as It Gets.
Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt.
It is.
And Greg Kinnear, I think. Okay, that one. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh yes, the infamous line. Yeah, we don't need crazy. We're fully stocked up here.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Then she goes and. And she writes out a 6-page thank you letter to him, and then she finishes it. She says, "But I'm not going to sleep with you." Yeah. And he looks at her and he says, "I just want my damn breakfast."
Yeah,
because it was actually, remember, it was a funny movie because he's doing these nice things not because he actually cares, although I think by the end of the movie he does start to care.
He says that you make me want to be a better man.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah.
But yeah, throughout most of
let's do it right. You make me want to be a better man.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing these things just for his own convenience.
Putting that IP, you know, in whatever. Okay. She had a lot of IP with this guy. Therefore, he used his resources that were worlds higher than hers in a financial sense, okay? But she provided something that he thought was essential to help out her son in a way that she was incapable of doing. So it was a nice symbiosis going on. And that's what you want in your role-playing games. You want people to set up these relationships with people, that people are helping each other out. NPCs are working with the PCs because everybody's winning. See, you know, that's when you know it's really working, is when either everybody's winning or everybody's getting a bad deal, but they're okay with that. You know, you know it's a fair deal when neither side's really that happy with it, but everybody still decides to do it anyways.
Like, yeah, it could be worse.
That's supposed to be a good deal. When one person is really happy and the other person is unhappy, then we know it's not a good deal. So, all right. So that's tracking that IP can be really important, and I think it's great. And we originally I talked about doing that a lot in Fringeworthy, but I think it kind of got lost, you know, in some of the later, you know, that's one reason why I really wanted to use things like D20 Modern and Fringeworthy, because you have these people that are world famous, and sometimes they need things and they need it right away. And by having influence points like that, they were rich, but they weren't, you know, ridiculously rich. But by having influence points, as you say, they could get things done that normally wouldn't be possible.
That reminds me of Cyberpunk, and the whole Rocker Boy class was pretty much based off of just using your popularity and influence to get things done, like to draw riots and mobs and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah, I never really got into the Glitter Boys. was that Cyberpunk, or was that
Glitter Boys? Oh, something else, but it was
that's very similar.
That's Riffs. Riffs. Okay. That's what it was.
The big suits with the rail guns on the shoulders. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. So then, of course, there's also the third type of campaign, which is survival. Post-apocalyptic, you crash land on a planet, you're out being a miner in the asteroid belt, an alien group has taken over and you're running for your life and you're in the underground. Okay. You know, in those, basically, you know, you're basically considered that everything you have, you're personally carrying with you. I mean, your wealth, even though you might theoretically have all this wealth, it doesn't matter. You know, you just have what you have, you know.
I was just thinking, it's almost, to my mind, it's almost like a reverse from like Heroic, where it's kind of come back around, where money itself and wealth itself doesn't really mean anything, because it's just another resource among all the other resources you're trying to acquire.
Right. And any resource or that almost every resource that you're trying to improve usually is at a great risk. Okay. You say you're out there mining in a radiation zone. Okay. Or you're, like I said, you're trying to get to that better place, that safe house, you know, but you have to cross all the zombies. So you just have the resources on you, and anything you might luck into along the way, you know, because once you get there, then they supposedly you'll be able to increase your resources, and then which could just maintain things for a little bit longer, or it might enable you then to do something more than you could before. Like maybe now you have cars that are available that are working, or maybe you have a doctor, you know, that's now can provide things for you. Before, all you had, again, was the clothes on your back and your dependent NPCs that you're dragging along and trying to keep the zombies from biting. You know, it's the survival mode is, and sometimes they, in any game, you may fall into it. I mean, pretty much, you know, a lot of dungeons are kind of like that, where you go into the dungeon and, you know, you have what you have, and nobody cares about you, who you are or how rich you are or anything else. If you didn't buy it before you came in, you don't have it. You can't get it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to decide. Again, that's one of the possible situations you may find yourself in, you know, a space station that's under siege, for example. can be a situation where you're in a survival mode where, you know, every, you know, the ship's set, you know, the computers are down, you know, now you're having to bust through security doors, things that you could have just waved a badge at before and waltzed right through. You know, it's good to do change-ups that way, but it's not something you want to do for a long-term basis, because, you know, it's when you're rolling, when you're literally rolling the dice on your survival, sooner or later you're going to crap out.
Yeah, yeah.
Bad luck's going to get you eventually.
Or somebody you care about is going to crap out. So, yeah. Okay. All right, so so right now we've got different ways of defining wealth. We have different kinds of genres, you know, as far as, you know, the heroic level. Okay, then it's like, okay, so when, you know, so how do you, you know, so based on that, we kind of already talked about how you track your resources and wealth. You know, one is you don't. You just assume that everything that you need is going to be available to you in the scenario, the heroic point of view. Or as long as it's under your wealth level or title, you can assume you either have it or can get it easily. And your living standards reflected by your wealth level or title. Or you have to track everything, but anything under a set cost is assumed that you have that $100 a day spending money, where you could just assume that you could go and buy something, okay? Or you literally have to track everything all the time, you know. So, okay, and so that's where you have to make these decisions now, you know, how you want to do these things. You know, first you decide how you can track money. You might want to decide first what kind of game it is, okay? Then you might say, okay, if I have to track wealth, how am I going to track it? Okay, in the sense of how do we define our wealth in the game? And then thirdly, you know, what do you really want to do? You know, if you really hate the minutia, don't do it. You know, use some other method of doing it.
Yeah, as far as all those various metrics, Bruce, I have an example. Do you know of the book from D20 Modern, D20 Apocalypse?
Yeah, but I've never actually read it.
Okay, they have something in there called TUs, or trade units, because obviously it would be...
For barter, right?
Yeah, it would be survival under your what type of game is it? You have what you personally carry, but in the right environment, it would cover your basic needs easily. And it would be that desert that you mentioned here in your, once again, patented Bruce Sheffer outline. So they have these trade units, and it's everything from, oh, it's a tin of canned food to a particular type of ammo to diesel fuel or gasoline or a first aid kit or anti-rad pills. And they have these TUs that everything is tracked. They put in there specifically, yeah, in the Apocalypse book, we're not using the D20. I mean, it's the D20 Modern rules, but it's like, due to the collapse of society and no, you know, standard, you know, we don't have our global computers that, you know, track credit cards and bank accounts. All that's collapsed. So it is a barter system. And the trade units is how that's their currency, as it were. And you have to track it because, you know, okay, I have this, you know, 9mm clip of ammo. I don't use a 9mm. Oh, you have a 9mm and you need ammo. You know, those cans of food over there look tasty. Give me two of those small tins. They look like tuna, and I'll give you this clip. You know, things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, in the video game Stalker, you know, they their basic money was essentially ammo. You bought everything with ammo. People paid you in ammo because you were constantly firing off guns in that game. Having ammo was important. You know, if you got into a big firefight, you might win, but then, you know, you might have essentially impoverished yourself because
You're alive, but you're poor.
You're poor, you know, because you need to use that. You need some ammo, and you have to decide: am I gonna buy food, you know, or am I gonna buy bandages with this ammo, or am I going to tough it out and keep it and maybe starve a little bit, you know, just so I have enough ammo to protect myself when I run into the many weird things that were in that game. And I always thought in apocalyptic size things, especially like a zombie apocalypse, that ammo should have been more of a form of specie. Okay. But that's one place where, because ammo is such an item that you track for everything, that's an example where, that most of the time every time you run into other people, that's going to be a big trade item, you know. And as you said, if you have ammo for guns you don't have, then that's going to, it's not doing you any good unless you can trade for ammo for guns that you do have, or things like body armor, food, clean bandages, unirradiated water. So those survival type things is where you usually track that sort of thing. But like Star Trek, for example, Star Trek, in every episode, they always have what they need to accomplish their goals. They may not realize it at the time. Sometimes the episode is about them realizing that they do have it, or it's about them repurposing an already existing thing that they have into something that they need. Like how many times they reconfigure the forward deflector array to do something amazing, right? So,
real quick, Bruce, you remember the playing evil characters and the gentleman which you, after I made the joke that we should use No One Loves You When You're Evil, Voltaire, he did another song about Star Trek, and it's called the USS Make Up, and it just has to do with what you were talking about. Yeah, they repurpose it, reconfigure the deflector dish.
The only thing they don't do on Star Trek is they don't magically have more starships appearing, unless, of course, it's an illusion. Big, really big items like starships have to be replaced, or more of them. That you're stuck with how many ships you have.
Because Star Trek is what they call a post-scarcity culture, where you're not fighting over resources anymore because, they got replicator technology.
Exactly.
The engineer needs a, what do they call that all the time in DuckTales? A 3/4 Pickney flange for the warp core. Boom. Yeah. You replicate it, you're good to go.
Yeah, it's just a matter of how long does it take to get it done.
Right, but still, because of the post-scarcity income, you're not quibbling over resources.
Right.
Well, the only real resources they I think, if I'm remembering as much as I can from the episodes, I think the only real resources they had to worry about were time, human resources, and diplomatic trust.
Sure.
The only time that you got into anything capitalistic was, those wonderful people. The Ferengi with their rules of acquisition.
Yeah.
Where they had the gold plate Slatinum and everything. My inner Breakmancy there.
And even then, the Enterprise or Federation never had to worry about money. It was just about how to get the Ferengi to give a good enough deal or to drop the capitalist, demand for, all the ship or, whatever, It wasn't about the Federation not being able to pay the Ferengi. It was about getting the Ferengi to ask for something that was sensible.
Or abide by their agreements.
Yeah.
Oh, no, because because in my previous Star Trek game, a couple Thursday games back, the last Thursday game, Breakman Z, so this would be Pixie's future stepfather, played a Ferengi named Torvis. Oh, no, we had the rules acquisition called up on Memory Alpha ready to go. because all of their convoluted little rules, which 99% of them actually made logical sense. And, oh, now I'm thinking about when Quark outlogics of Vulcan with the rules of acquisition. The only way it would have been better is if it was a iconic Vulcan like Spock or Sarek or somebody. No, it was just some Vulcan arms dealer. But no, still, the Ferengi, yeah, they were a capitalist society, so they dealt with commerce and trade and currency, and they actually revered Wall Street. A tourist attraction on Earth for Ferengi was, well, what was Wall Street in Earth's, you know, Federation Earth's New York City. And they're like, why did you quit this? This is a temple. Why did you leave capitalism? This is wonderful. You know, this is when you humans were great. You know, yeah. But no, with Star Trek, yeah, that's the thing. Until you got to pretty much DS9. Yeah, you never heard about anything requiring, we need money for this, we need money for that. But it's also because you were in a, well, I guess a paramilitary exploration agency, Starfleet. So yeah, everything, if you needed it, was either requisitioned or replicated. Yeah, so yeah, it was DS9 and the Ferengi that really got us back into, yeah, we need this and we need to pay for it. How much are you willing to give, or how much are you willing to trade, or, excuse me, ooh.
Yeah, well, if you want something that's illegal, you know, even if you're in a post-scarce society, how are you going to get your hands on it without some form of money?
Well, then that, you know, like, you know, how McCoy did in Star Trek 2. Romulan ale, this is illegal. Now, only keep it for medicinal purposes, Jim. You know that McCoy traded probably some extra, oh, I have these surgical supplies or something. Yeah, here, so give this to the guy on the Romulan ship, and I'll take the couple bottles of ale. Or like, oh God, Picard, his kid, Jack Crusher. He carried Romulan ale with him on that ship. Spoiler alert, folks, even though it's been a year, he would have, you know, the medical supplies that him and Beverly were ferrying from planet to planet. But all of a sudden the guy comes, oh, Romulan ale, and just Crusher right away. Well, you wouldn't believe the medicinal purposes it has. You know? So, yeah, it was still a barter system, you know, even though it was a post-scarcity income. There was when there wasn't currency, they reverted back to barter. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, so, it, as I said, the Ferengi, I think, were the only time that they really brought in anything about need of wealth. So yeah, I recall any other species.
Yeah, there was a game called Dogs in the Vineyard, which was essentially a training manual for Mormons. But it was about a bunch of guys who were called their group was the Dogs, you know, God's Dogs, and they would go to a town, and their job was to ferret out all the injustice and sin in the town. And get them to basically recant from their behaviors.
What was this? A book? A movie?
It was an RPG. It's no longer available. It was called Dogs in the Vineyard. And of course, the vineyard, what, you know, this is what they did. They raised these guys up to be, you know, leaders, but they had to prove themselves. And so they would send them out in groups to a town that was having a problem, and it was their job to basically fix the town. And they were judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, if they decided to do something, you know, but they could do it. And they had all authority. So when they came into town, then, yes, the people would put them up, and they would feed them, and they would take care of them while they went around and asked questions and confronted people about various things. And the GM was basically, his job was to take this community and figure out what were all the secrets in the community, and then in a way it was an investigation. It was much like a Bureau 13 adventure where you had to figure out what's really going on, you know, and then bring it all up to a head, you know, resolve it, decide how the town's going to move forward, and then you're done. You get to go home.
I'm imagining these guys going into a town like Twin Peaks.
That would be fun.
That'd be a campaign.
Right. But this is, again, another example where, because of who they are, they don't have to worry about anything. Their job is to do what they came there for. And I don't know enough about the game to know whether they had specific any things for gathering information and stuff like that. I do know that, you know, that they basically used I don't want to use the word intimidation, but you basically used your standing, you know, to force people to tell you the truth.
So, yeah, it sounds like, in a way, these guys were like Pathfinder Inquisitors. Like a sort of a secret military arm of whatever church that you happen to have your god in. Yeah. You said it was Mormons?
Yes. Yeah, it was definitely has a very Mormon slant to it.
Okay.
And I believe the mythology behind it is, but anyways, it's which is not to say anything bad about that. I mean, I'm saying is that I'm glad, you know, it was the darling of the podcast community for a very long time. They thought that this is a great game because it wasn't the standard go in, kill the monster kind of thing. It was all about relationships. You know, there was another one called The Witch on the Mountain, where the whole point of the adventure is for you to come to a point where you're willing to betray your group and join the Witch on the Mountain. And so as you go along, the GM basically starts revealing facts to you about your background and the other people you're with and how they've treated you in the past, and vice versa. I mean, how you've treated other people. And so the question is, when you finally confront the witch, you know, is there going to be enough people to defeat them, or are you going to be facing off against most of your party who've basically gone over to the witch's side? So there's a lot of brinkmanship involved in that. So, and that again, that's another game like that. So there were a whole bunch of them that came out that people just and they were very, very popular amongst female gamers, by the way, because they had so much relationship information in them. You know, they weren't hard combat type things.
Yeah. There was actually role playing done.
And
yeah.
When I mentioned when I played Pendragon at a convention recently, Dice and Diversions, I had this character, and not anywhere on there did I care about wealth. I mean, it was all about me following the passions of my character. It was all about me being under one person or another, and I would confront people, you know. Knowing that my house backed me up, and I would ask, you know, questions like, how does this serve chivalry, you know, and so forth, and it would literally rock, you know, in some cases it would rock the person back on their heels, the NPC, because I was literally, you know, my passion, my standing in that. You know, they would accept me as an authority, and they would have to examine their own motivations and decide whether or not they were doing the right thing and sometimes change their behavior. So, or, you know, a couple of times there was some combat, and which I managed to do very well in. But I'm just saying is that, you know, nowhere in there that was a one shot, but I'm just saying, did I ever care about money? You know, and the resources that I had was pretty much what was, you know, my steel, you know, my horses, you know, my squire, you know, and joining up with other knights, you know, in the same area to do great things, you know, or whatever needed to be done. So that's using that whole peeries, knight, you know, authority, all the stuff we talked about. So they're coming out with like a new edition of Pendragon, by the way. So if you never played it, or you thought that was this game that they played back in the beginning of role playing and it just kind of died and disappeared, it's still there. It's, you know, and they've done a lot of good stuff with it. So I enjoyed playing it quite a bit.
Are they just coming out of it, or there be a, is it like a crowdfunding thing that we might be able to throw a?
Oh yeah, it's almost everything is a crowdfunding thing, but I don't know whether it's out already.
Okay.
It's something that's still in the works, but what I worked with was like a character sheet, and the GM was handing those out, so he might have had an early version of it, or it might even been a working, you know, a working sample for the purposes of promoting it. So I don't know. I run into that all the time with, you know, games like E-Cream and stuff where they have a fast start, and but the real game is still coming out in the near future. I have a piece of that, by the way. I've got the player's manual in PDF, and the hardback is coming in a few months. Anyways, so that's pretty much all I have on wealth. Is to say, make sure that you're not, you know, that you're tracking wealth in a way that enhances your gameplay rather than gets in the way of it, keeps you from doing the things you want to do.
I do remember, and my Sifu, Mark Herbert, told me about this years ago when he was talking about other, because I met my Sifus because they played EverQuest with my now second ex-wife. So we talked about MMORPGs, and there was a Star Wars one. And it was an MMORPG, just like EverQuest or World of Warcraft or City Heroes. But they had a facet where you could get some type of domicile. And you could store all your stuff there. Problem is, if you did not regularly exercise a craft skill that your Star Wars character had, you would lose that house with all of the stuff in it. My Sifu looked at me and he told me that. And he looked at me and said, if I want to do that, I won't turn on my computer. I do that with work. And I'm like, that's a point well taken. Yeah, you have that role-playing game, which is involved with the minutia of going through stuff that you get away from by playing the game. Because you have to, do the craft skill to monitor your money, to make sure you have the house, and if you don't do it enough. And it's like, yeah, it takes away from the fun of the game if you're having to do, you know, like I said, the D20 balancing your checkbook, you know. Yeah, I would see that in order to enhance a story, you shouldn't have to have the skill, you know, checkbook balancing. Just, it gets in the way of the flow of the game. Have it as you need it. And now if you have people who want to do this, that's fine. Let them, you know, just be the number cruncher, the team's accountant. Okay, well, you have 500 gold and you spent 100 on that potion. You have 400 left to buy, you know, more potions there, Falgar. And, you know, you want a new wand, but yeah. You could give that like to a player and have their character be the adventuring party's CPA. But I would see still, usually from my own experience, the number crunching just slows things down. And the way that you put this, Bruce, where it's usually if you have like some means of things that you can get stuff from, like requisitioning. By the way, D20 Modern also has requisition rules. If you are an agency like
Bureau 13.
Well, Bureau 13 had it, but there was one specifically in Department 7. They used Department 7. Oh, it's just the government agency and you handle weird missions or just stuff that the cops can't handle. And sure, you know, you can. It was like D20 plus your charisma mod plus a modifier due to how important it is into the mission. Well, I need a computer that has hacking programs and you're doing a data run. Yeah, you're going to get the high requisition modifier to help you get it. So, yeah, they had requisition rules in D20 Modern as well as the wealth system. That's usually you're involved either with a corporation, an agency, military. So, yeah, bean counting, in my experience, just tends to slow down just the flow of the game. Because it helps, it removes your suspension of disbelief, I guess would be the best way to say it. It would have it where, yeah, this is like balancing my checkbook. I have to do that every month. Why do I'm playing a game. I don't want to have to do that. I don't have to worry about, you know, did I pay the electric this month? You know, just, yeah, I see it as a speed bump to play in the game. I get that's just the best way I can describe it, and it's why I use the wealth system even if I'm playing a fantasy game. It's just, okay, do we just moving this along? We're not bean counting. Let's just, you know, get going with, you know, whatever adventure. Yeah, so but no, personally, I don't see anything else that you once again, an airtight outline, sir. Just yeah, I'm not seeing anything missing. Jonathan, you?
No, I mean, I've got, reiterating what we've talked about is, you know, figure out, you know, early on what you want to do. Like how much does wealth and money, is it going to matter in your, you know, campaign or it's not campaign, your game? How much do you want? And, you know, because, you know, when you're talking about, like, say, cyberpunk or space bounty hunters, you know, money's probably going to be a big thing because it's your primary reward for completing the missions. Because, you know, most cyberpunk campaigns, you're the edge runners, you're the shadow runners, you're the ones doing the dirty work for the corpse in the, you know, shadows of the alleys.
Mm-hmm. Well, in games like cyberpunk and also D&D and other types of things, a lot of times, the gear that you confiscate or scavenge while you're doing the mission sometimes makes a big difference. You know, that sometimes that is your primary reward in these games, and they're not wealth. They just enhance your ability to do things in the future.
The spoils of war, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for example, is that, you know, in our Fringeworthy game, all right, they have a flying saucer that can travel up into orbit. They have a number of blasters that do a lot of damage. They have a bunch of stunners that do a bunch of damage. Okay, you know, these are all from previous adventures. Okay, right now they've got a dragon. They just found out the dragon's fringeworthy. So that means that they can bring it back with them and keep it with the party. It's a 150-foot-long dragon that's going to eat a couple of cows a day, but it is a dragon that they can.
Did they hug it? Did they hug it and pet it and stroke it? And if it was bad, they went and they called it George. Yeah,
they're thinking about trying to get rid of it. Is what they're trying to do, because it's too much, I think, for them. But these are things that they picked up as they went along, and as long as it's not the only one that exists, or it's too high of a tech level for anybody to do a research on, you know, IDET's been letting them keep these things. They use them. I don't think they don't really pick up on the cool factor, but I'm just saying is that none of these translate into wealth or influence, except shock and awe. Okay, there are.
Yeah.
But frankly, I think they're doing better with the grenade launchers with the shock and awe than they are doing with the blasters and the stunners and the laser pistols. So it's just kind of, you know, whatever. It's they have a whole bunch of anti-plant rifles.
Oh yeah, that campaign. Okay, yeah, I remember you've mentioned that. Yeah.
Okay. That, which means that they could go and fire it and take down a wall with it. But fire it at a person, the worst it would do would be give them indigestion, because all their flora in their intestines would go dead.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but it wouldn't actually hurt them, you know, because it's anti-plant device. You know, it's MacGuffin. So I'm just saying is a lot of times you're rewarded in games without using money. Okay, but I think almost every game that's out there, in some, except like Star Trek or something of its ilk, okay, if they don't give you money, if they don't give you gear, they're going to have to give you influence, or titles or things like that, so that you can use that to find the awesome that you want to bring to your game and add to your game. And I like it when a wealth system is set up in a way, which I think the one in D20 is, modern, where you can get cool gear, even if you don't, even when on paper it doesn't look like you could afford it. You actually still can. And that's something that was missing out of the game. because most people were playing things like D&D, where you literally get out of school or training camp or whatever, and you've got like 20, 30 gold pieces. And from that point on, it's just a matter of you fighting monsters and collecting treasure until you can afford nice things. Or find nice things, okay? And, you know, that's a particular kind of thing, but I really think that that's not a campaign model. That's a one-shot adventure model. I think when you start role-playing your character, you're going to start looking for things like that. And so it's really good to have something like a wealth rating in, you know, or a wealth system in your game that works for your players. Anyways, thanks everybody for listening to us. We hopefully you've found some good things to add to your campaigns, or maybe change to another version if you've been using the track all your gold, and maybe, you know, and everybody's tired of doing that, always feeling like they can't get the stuff they need. Well, here's another way of tracking wealth that might make just as much sense or even more. So we hope you'll use it, and if you do, tell us how it changed your games, especially if it caused a lot of ruckus, because we love hearing those kinds of stories. And we'll have more for you next week, but you'll have to wait. Until then.
This is Bruce Sheffer saying there are a million, million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction, and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.